Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Who was Joan of Arc, really? Nearly six centuries after her brief life and dramatic execution, Joan remains a beloved national heroine in France. She has been canonized a saint in the Catholic Church and immortalized in movies and plays. But skeptics wonder whether the angel voices that drove her to take up a sword and lead men into battle were brought on not by divine grace, but by physical or even mental illness. Author Catherine Harrison spent years studying France's Hundred Years' War with England in her search for the truth about Joan, and she has carefully read extant documents that detail Joan's life and the alleged heresies for which she was burned at the stake and later posthumously acquitted. The new book by Catherine Harrison is called Joan of Arc, A Life Transfigured. She's in town to appear tonight as part of Highland Park United Methodist Church's Authors Live series. Catherine, welcome to Think.
Oh, thank you for having me.
What was the biggest unanswered question for you about Joan when you started your research?
Well, of course, like everybody else, I wanted to know about the voices. And I had the trial records long before I started work on the book. And she's a fascinating, fascinating person. I was really interested in the huge the huge response to her cross-dressing. And I think just because she's sort of the counter-narrative. She refuses to fit in the outline drawn for a woman of the 15th century. And I really like defiant people, and I can't really think of anybody more defiant than Joan of Arc.
Of course, in order to understand Joan, we, like you, have to get a sense of the times in which she lived. She was born into a country at war, died in a country at war, never really knew full peace. Can you talk about what the source of conflict was at that time between England and France?
Well, I won't bore you with all the dynastic complications, but at the time that Joan was born, it was about 75 years into the Hundred Years' War, which is actually the 116-year war, and France was in desperate straits. England had occupied all of the country above the Loire, and Orléans, where Joan raised the siege, was a very critical point because the English were about to break through the Loire and come into the south of France. And, you know, just think of it. France becoming England. What would have happened to the food?
How many people were fighting at any one time?
Well, to us, it would probably seem like not very many. I mean, the armies, an army of 3,000 would be very big.
Mm-hmm. In shorthand descriptions, Joan is often called a French peasant. What did that mean, and what do we actually know about the circumstances in which she grew up?
Well, a peasant is not an aristocrat, usually laborers. She was born at a time when the whole system of serfdom was breaking down, largely because of the famines and the plague in the previous century had decimated the population. So the whole social fabric was very slippery at the time. And Joan was a peasant, but she was not a simple person or the sort of simple shepherdess that people like to portray her as. She was highly intelligent and unusually aware of the political situation because her father was the dean of the town, Domremy, where she was born. So he had a lot of contact with other higher-ups who had contact with the king. And it's an oral culture. News is passed from mouth to mouth, and he was on the road, and he knew what was going on, so that when Joan's angels told her to go to Robert Baudricourt, it wasn't a name she'd never heard. And she wasn't at all a simple shepherdess. I think that hagiography likes to push saints toward that direction of, you know, like Christ with his flock.
And a lot of the narratives about her have sort of organized themselves around the similarities between the life of Joan of Arc and the life of Jesus.
Absolutely. That was one of the things that I found most interesting at first, and still do after years of looking at it, because not not only did her trajectory as a messianic figure really align with his, but she came out of a political situation, born into a political situation that was very much like the one that Jesus was born into. The land was occupied by the Romans. It was a corrupt clerics who ran the show. The people were all poor. A lot of them were starving. And the situation in France is very similar. It's just that the English are the occupiers, still have the same corrupt clergy. And
any sense of the kind of Catholicism that she would have practiced?
Well, I guess that's part of the problem with her. Unlike most mystics, she never went through clerical channels. And, you know, at this point, there's no separation of church and state. So whatever Catholicism she practiced, I'm sure, was externally pretty orthodox. She was baptized. She went to church on Sundays. And, you know, she knew her prayers. And she was probably pretty typical. But everybody believed the same thing.
So she starts hearing voices when she's, what, about 12 or 13?
Yes, she said a voice from God came to her in her 13th year.
She decides not to tell anybody initially. Mm-hmm. Was she worried that people would think she was crazy, or what was the reason that she kept this a secret?
Well, I think that, you know, she didn't even talk about her childhood. She was completely uninterested in it until the voices arrived. I'm not somebody who thinks that she's schizophrenic or physically ill, partly because I don't think mental illness tends to organize people and make them more
effective. Heroes, right,
yes,
yeah.
Exactly. But she essentially stepped out of the mortal world that we all live in and began communicating with voices that she heard that she believed were sent from God. And I think she really felt that she had been removed from the company of normal other mortals. And she had something that was enormously exciting. And it was probably just an instinctive sense of keeping it to yourself. Because, of course, if you tell somebody, you know, that angels are coming to you and telling you things, then even in the Middle Ages, they might think there was something wrong with you or try to kind of manage it from the outside. And that was definitely not something she wanted at all.
What do you have to do when you're writing a biography like this to organize this sense of whether you actually believe in a religious sense or whether you believe in a supernatural sense or whether you think there must have been some cause that's not entirely apparent to us, but some explainable reason that she was hearing these voices? How do you deal with that?
Well, I think the first thing that's important about her voices is that she absolutely believed that angels were talking to her, and she even said that she could touch them, and, you know, she saw them, a really full experience. But, oh gosh, I've lost the track. What'd you ask?
Well, how do you decide, do you have to decide what you believe in order to write a book like this?
I guess I believe that she did have genuine mystical experience, and I do believe that there are people who are able to step through the veil of this very material life and perhaps experience other realities. So I'm not somebody who would be immediately skeptical about hearing voices, which is not as uncommon as people believe. There's plenty of mentally healthy people who hear things that other people don't.
But nobody talks about
them. Exactly. That's probably instinctive. So I don't think it really matters to the story what anybody thinks are the sources of the voices. What matters is what she believed about them and how it transformed her and the validity that she felt in this communication.
So as the voices started guiding her to take up a sword and go into battle and get a horse, the first thing she said was, I don't know how to ride a horse. This is clearly not me. It's poignant to think about her hesitancy to go forth with this thing she believed she was being told to do.
Yes. She did get guidance from the angels, and they did instruct her in terms of how she was to accomplish what she was trying to do. But yes, it's an amazing story. She's clearly somebody who has, whatever else was true about her, she was very gifted intellectually, and she was in some ways sort of superhumanly strong. All of the knights who fought with her commented on it. Typically, it took a knight, I don't know, I think they trained for 6 weeks or something to get used to the weight of armor, which could go up to 50 pounds. And, you know, Joan put on her armor and slept in it. and, you know, she learned to ride with, well, there's some sort of speculation as to what it means to say, I do not know how to ride. She could have meant, I do not know how to ride a charger, which is a very specific kind of animal built for war, really the knight's strongest weapon.
What do we know about her physically? Are there descriptions of what she looked like?
I think that all we know with relative certainty is that she had black hair. She was probably about 5'7", a little bit tall for a woman of her age, because she could, before she had men's clothes made for her, she easily fit into ones that she borrowed. Because she was burned as a heretic and a witch, any likeness that was made of her in her lifetime was destroyed. So we really don't know what she looks like. And, of course, this has been a great invitation for artists. And she tends to be portrayed as a sort of Valkyrie with these long blonde tresses and very unlike what she probably looked like.
Why did she dress like a man? Or I guess she must have dressed like a boy initially because she was so young.
I think that, well, there were the practical considerations, which are what she always brought up, was that there was no way to go to war in a dress.
Not one that reaches the floor.
And people rightly noted that, well, she wore men's clothes when she wasn't at war, too. And both for her judges and for herself, it really became a symbol of her entire defiance, because Joan's sort of the counter narrative in terms of women's lives, and is very clear that she has no interest in women's work. She dismissed it as for other women, and she had what she believed was a true vocation, and it was to lead a war. And I think when she discovered the tailor-made clothes that people were eager to give her once she became the national heroine, she discovered she really liked them. And she was criticized for her vanity. And that's another thing I like about her, just writing about a saint who sort of turns out to be also a fop at the same time.
Look at these gorgeous shoes. I kind of like that, too, especially because I had assumed that maybe her temperament was rather masculine. And perhaps it was, but she, that doesn't mean you can't like pretty clothes.
Yeah, I think her temperament was probably very androgynous, actually. I don't think she connected with women or men. She really believed herself apart.
Yeah, it's interesting when you think about, like, in certain cultures, they have that the idea of a third gender. Maybe that's what she was, except that there was no way to express that in France in the 15th century.
Yeah. I think that it, her choice to wear men's clothing, I think, was deliberately provocative in some ways. She was somebody who had a clear idea of the effect it had on other people, which was, at the time, just completely and totally startling. It made her bigger, the fact that she was wearing men's clothes, and it sort of made her complete unto herself.
We're speaking this hour with Catherine Harrison. Her new book is called Joan of Arc, A Life Transfigured. We'll come back to the conversation in a moment. You can join it at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for January to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author Catherine Harrison about her new book, Joan of Arc, A Life Transfigured. She's in town to appear tonight as part of Highland Park United Methodist Church's Authors Live series. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. What gave Joan the kind of influence she needed to lead men? It's one thing to be strong and smart and clever and brave in the 15th century as a woman. It's another thing to convince men that you are all of those things.
Well, it did take some time for her to convince them of her abilities and also of the source of the voices. So she was heavily vetted before she was allowed to begin her career. And, you know, she had her horse, she had her armor, and she discovered that she really had to convince the other generals that she worked with of her abilities. It was a time in which, it sounds odd to us, but a military leader's abilities were connected with his virtue. Mm-hmm. So the fact that she was this model of chastity and virtue was automatically accorded her a certain amount of respect. And the other thing is that France is in such a desperate straits when she arrives on the scene, that her outsized optimism, certainty, and charisma was a great deal to do with it, because there was nobody in France who felt like anything good was going to happen. In fact, France had been at war for 75 years. They were definitively losing for 75 years. I mean, you've had famines, plague, and the English. And the country had fallen into a sort of apathy and despair. And to have a creature like Joan, with this wild energy and strength and belief, I think was very effective. I mean, people wanted to look at this person. Who is this person that believes everything's going to turn out all right? And then, of course, there are the voices. And it's difficult to understand Joan now, because she's somebody she doesn't make much sense in her own time, but she is somebody who lived in the Middle Ages. And to understand anything about her, I think you have to make yourself a citizen of the Middle Ages, and that was a lot of what writing this book was about. She performed miracles, and the leader that she worked with most closely, Dunois, told the story of raising the siege and having to get the boats of supplies to Orléans. And, you know, Jones said, you know, we have to get across the river right now. We have to get the food to the people who were starving inside the city walls. And Dunois looked up and he said, you know, the wind is in the wrong direction. We can't sail get these barges to Orléans when the wind is blowing them the other way. And Joan just looked up and said, it's shifted, clearly claiming the the responsibility. And Dunois said, you know, at that moment, he was convinced that she was truly sent from God and that she would lead the army. And she had conflicts with some generals who not only objected to her being a woman, but also her lowly status as a peasant.
Can you talk about why her virginity was such a big deal? I think people recognize that this was, it didn't mean the same in the 15th century as it does now, but this was almost like central to her
identity.
Anointing and her identity.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. Chastity is very important at the time, and once she announced herself to the French people, she called herself the Virgin, La Pucelle. And what she was as a virgin was an uncorrupted mediator between God and the French people. The only thing that they could think of that would help them out of this dire situation was God. But clearly, somehow, they'd fallen into disfavor, and they needed some kind of intercessor. And there were prophecies, which is also a really interesting part of the story, because there was a prophecy that was specific to Joan's, to Lorraine, where Joan lived, and that was that a virgin would arise from the marshes of Lorraine and save France. And prophecy is interesting because, you know, in a situation like this, you can think of it as a wish or a communal prayer. So in that sense, Joan was in some ways invented by her own people. So everybody knew the prophecy. Some probably dismissed it. Others believed it. But Joan was the person who stepped forward and said, yes, and I'm that virgin.
And there were a lot of people willing and eager to corroborate that, even in contemporary accounts where people would say she was like followed around by this cloud of butterflies. And there were all these signs that, you know, had it happened to someone else, people might not have associated that with holiness or being very special. But in Joan's case, to the people around her, it all added up to proving that she was who she said she was.
Yes. And her virginity went beyond her sexuality and had a lot to do with the fact that she wouldn't talk about her voices, for example. The mystics of the era typically produced these really overheated, erotic even experiences that they'd had with their heavenly bridegroom. I mean, we all know the Bernini sculpture of St. Therese writhing under the great spear that's being thrust into her. And
no metaphor there.
No. And you know, they're like fever dreams. They're lush and overheated and erotic. And Joan was illiterate. She dictated some letters, but she didn't write. And she was completely not only uninterested in sharing the experience, but unwilling to be penetrated in that way either. She didn't go through clerical channels, and she never went to her village priest and said, look, you know, something really weird happened to me in my father's garden, which is what other female mystics did in the era. They all had connections with the church. They went to the church with their experience. Joan did not.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also get to the show by sending email to think@kera.org. Let's speak on the phone now to Augustine in Fort Worth. Hi, Augustine.
Hi, how are you today?
Very well, thank you.
Such an interesting topic. My comment is only to reaffirm that there are people that perceive things that are supernatural and we don't understand, but they really learn things from previous lives. I don't doubt it that now. My son died 2 years ago. He prayed at night, and he was inspired ever since he was a little boy about those things from the Middle Ages, and I didn't know where he got it from. Riding a horse, I never owned one, but he was so good at it, and his entire life was devoted to that. And ironically, he died in Coventry, where there is the legend of Lady Godiva, and it was so interesting. Now that I look back, I realize that a short, very full life was lived because previously he had experienced those things and been inspired by previous lives in which he played a real knight and really did some things that some other people witness and relate to. And what John of Arc did was to perceive that from other.
I think we lost the connection, Augustine. First of all, I'm so sorry for your loss, and I completely understand the way that you relate to Joan of Arc having this short but very full life. I think that's something that a lot of people are drawn to, the idea that she was so young and is so well remembered.
Absolutely. Her youth makes the story that much more impossible and fascinating, and also, it, you know, just the vision of that girl tied to a stake in Rouen, and which was completely occupied by the English and the Burgundians, who were their allies. Throngs of people waiting to watch a girl burn. And I think it is one of the things that people find most sympathetic about her youth.
And she was very tough. Like, there's this scene where she's, I didn't even know what a cross bolt was, but she basically takes like a direct hit that would have felled anybody, and gets up and keeps on going.
Yeah, and that was another thing that impressed everybody and scared the English, because they thought they'd killed her, you know, and everybody was screaming, you know, death to the witch is dead, and Joan was taken away from the battlefield by her comrades, and they took off her armor and they dressed the wound. Somebody came forward with a little charm and wanted to lay it on the wound, and she said no, she'd rather die than do something that would offend God. Mm. And she insisted on returning to battle. The crossbolt went into her neck and probably down behind her collarbone, and it was said to be 6 inches deep, and a miracle that she wasn't killed, and that she stood up and said, okay, let's go back into battle. And for the English, this is terrifying. You know, they thought she was dead. Then she went into the woods and came out alive. Yeah.
So what kind of relationship did she have with the king? This is Charles VII, right? Mm-hmm. After she drove the English out, and how did she end up being captured and not sort of ransomed by France?
Well, that is something, that's a question that people have asked ever since she was alive and captured. It was a sort of ambiguous and difficult political situation, because once the English had Joan and were trying her as a witch, suddenly Charles's anointment was thrown into suspicion, because her vocation, as she understood it, was to restore the crown to Charles, whose mother had disinherited him, basically, and called his paternity into question.
This is the interesting point that I want you to explain. Okay. This. His mother called his paternity into question.
Yes. No. Well, no, it was called. Yes, actually. She agreed that he might not be her son, right, because she had had affairs with so many other people.
Which wasn't so unusual for royalty in their day.
Well, I think she probably got a bye because her husband was completely insane.
all right, continue. Sorry for that detour.
Right. So her vocation was to win the war and lead Charles to Reims, the cathedral where all kings were anointed, because rule is by divine right. And the fact that she was suddenly not talking to angels but potentially talking to Satan called his anointment as king into question. It sort of tainted it. And I think her alienation from Charles began long before she was captured. Once she had put the crown on his head, she became a lot less interesting, and in fact, she was a very problematic figure. So the French court was divided on what should be done about her, how much influence she had, and you know, Charles is like any other king. He probably didn't really like being upstaged by a 19-year-old girl, or she was 19 when she died, a 17-year-old girl, And in fact, nobody was interested in Charles. There was somebody far more interesting to pay attention to, and that was problematic. And, you know, I think he would probably exploited her. And there were also other considerations. The town of, I mean, other people have asked, why didn't they go to war to get her back? But Rouen was so heavily fortified that it would have been suicidal for anybody to try to rescue her. Yeah, so he betrayed her.
So the French and Burgundy were aligned with the English. They were the ones who handed her over. The English tried her for heresy, is that correct?
Yes, and witchcraft. Mm-hmm. Heresy because she separated herself from orthodoxy, and witchcraft because of the miracles she was said to have done, which included raising a baby from the dead. And I forgot where we were.
Tried for heresy. And then there was also this whole issue that even when she was kept in prison, she refused to wear. Once again, we're back to the won't wear women's clothes thing.
Yeah. She was kept in prison and tried by 70 clerics. And she had a really hard time in prison. She was constantly under threat of rape. She was not put in a church prison, as she should have been, because it was an inquisitorial trial. And she, she's just an astounding person to stand up in front. I mean, that was one of the reasons I fell in love with her at first, because I had read the trial records. And her voice is so potent, and her sort of impertinence with the people who she knew were going to kill her. Just a figure of such integrity.
She remains defiant even after they have unjustly imprisoned her.
Yeah. And the clothing thing, as I said, was it became more and more symbolic of her refusal to comply on both sides. The whole conflict between Joan and the church and Joan and society was the clothes, the male clothes symbolized that. And it was about having her take the pants off, but it was also about breaking her defiance. And that wasn't going to happen. She was defiant, and she would not submit.
We're speaking this hour with author Catherine Harrison about her new book, Joan of Arc, A Life Transfigured. She's in town to appear tonight as part of Highland Park United Methodist Church's Authors Live series. We'll resume our conversation in a couple of minutes, and you can join it by emailing think@kera.org or sending a tweet to me @ChrisBoydThink.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for January to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Catherine Harrison. Her new book is called Joan of Arc, A Life Transfigured. She'll speak tonight at Highland Park United Methodist Church's Authors Live series. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Why was burning at the stake the way that Joan was to be executed? And why was that particular method like more upsetting to her than any of the other awful things they might have done to her?
Burning at the stake was the standard way to dispatch a heretic. And in Joan's case, it was very important to them that her body be completely destroyed so that nobody would sort of come up with a little relic to hang on to. The Catholic faith you can't be cremated as a Catholic
you couldn't then.
Right. Because of the belief in the resurrection of the body, so that to be resurrected, you needed a body. And Joan was, weeping and distraught at the idea. She said, I'd rather 1,000 times have my head cut off or whatever, because she wanted a body left behind. She wasn't afraid of death as much as of losing it. And her response is, she rarely seems despairing, but that one piece of information, that was how she was going to go, really upset her.
I guess it was typical to sort of, this is a little bit graphic, but to strangle people before their bodies were burned.
Right. In the case of Joan, because there was such interest in her and so many people wanted to attend the burning, she was burned on a platform that was high above the crowd watching. And the executioner complained that he didn't have a chance to be merciful with her as he did with other people that were burned, because he would strangle them with, I don't know, a rope or whatever, so that they didn't suffer in the way that Joan did. And you know, being burned to death wasn't necessarily that fast.
Yeah.
You know, if lots of things change at the wind's direction, its speed, and in some cases, it was designed to be as excruciating as possible, you know, to have the heat approach slowly and eat you up from the bottom up. Or sometimes you died of smoke inhalation, but it was obviously a gruesome way to die. Mm-hmm. So executioners usually helped a little bit, but it was the height that did it.
So as dramatic as everything that you've described has been, maybe that would have been that had the war continued to proceed the way it had. But there was kind of a reversal of fortunes for England, right? Not too long after she was executed?
Yeah, the tide turned, and in the year following her execution, the war sort of fizzled for a while, and then improbably Charles somehow regained the force that he was reputed to have before his mother disowned him, and the French army was revolutionized because he came and inspected it and saw what a disaster it was. So it was in some way, and then we also have the beginning of artillery, and there were the French were ahead of the game in terms of artillery. You know, the English had the longbow for so long, and that was one of the ways that they won at Agincourt or any of them, because the longbows had such they traveled so much further and with more accuracy.
So it's like high tech weaponry,
right? Mm-hmm. That the French, you know. They lost, I can't even remember how many at Agincourt, but it was a disaster. We still talk about it.
How did it happen that Joan was retried, and on what grounds was she exonerated?
Well, she was...
Not that it did her any good.
No, she was, yes, She, 25 years after her death, there was a movement that began in Orléans, actually, where she had always remained a heroine, a folk hero. They didn't believe she was a witch. And the cause was undertaken to have the trial examined. You know, sort of like with the Nazis and keeping records, the Inquisition was punctilious in not only taking notes on the trial and leaving a record, but having it published and bound and sent around. So after time went by, and if you read them, you could see that, you know, it was a kangaroo court. It was completely unfair. We've got one girl unrepresented by anybody against 70 church fathers who've been trained at the Sorbonne. And in the beginning of the trial, she asks for a representation. And then in the end, she's left with just her voices. And she even complains in the courtroom that there's too much chaos and she can't hear what they're telling her. So she... why do I keep losing the track of this?
Well, the idea that she was ultimately acquitted in the second trial.
Right. After the war was over and the English were back where they belonged, it became important to rehabilitate the image of Joan. And while it's popularly displayed or narrated as something undertaken at first by her mother, who did initiate the trial by reading a prepared statement, it was actually Charles who set the ball in motion, because now that the English were gone, he doesn't want the taint of suspicion associated with his kingship. Mm-hmm. So, and again, church and state are one, not separate. And he started the ball rolling, actually, in terms of collecting evidence and, you know, getting depositions from all the people that she fought with and from people in her hometown, and building a case that this was actually a very virtuous young woman and she had been unfairly tried. And so the verdict was overturned. It's called often the retrial of Joan of Arc, but it's a nullification trial in terms of what the church calls it. So it nullified the verdict and she was innocent again.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Cynthia on the line in Irving. Hello, Cynthia.
Hi. I wanted to ask your author if what she thought about Mark Twain's version of the Joan of Arc story and why he remained anonymous about being the author of it.
I'm not sure, especially since he considered it his best book, which I definitely don't consider it. He was fascinated by her. There's a picture of him in the New York Times from ages ago at some big reception where a girl is dressed up as Joan of Arc. She was sent to amuse him by somebody. Many people were fascinated by her, and he actually made the statement that she was second only to Jesus.
We have an email here from Joey in Denton who says, should this story really be presented as a factual depiction of events from the voices, vetting of being sent by God, superhuman strength and changing winds? Seems like it's taking wild liberty in this modern day. How might you present this to non-believers who see practical explanations for everything that's been discussed?
I hope the book is one that leaves the opportunity for the reader to decide. I'm interested in story. Mm-hmm. I'm a storyteller. And when I began this book, it was with the intention of preserving the mystery of Joan of Arc. I think many biographers set out with the intention of cutting her down to mortal size and saying, you know, she was suffering from hallucinations caused by tuberculosis or schizophrenia. But that wasn't my agenda. I just thought this is a really great story. And it's also a story that allows you to really play with the idea of narrative, because there is a core of facts that have been preserved. For a woman of the Middle Ages who was not an aristocrat or royalty, Joan's life is remarkably well documented, because she was, in essence, not only by the trials, but she was Europe's first superstar, really. You know, there were letters flying across Europe from one country to another about what she was doing next and now. And so there's a wealth of documentation from the time. Now, she did enter the picture as sort of a living myth, and it was very different in the Middle Ages. You know, the idea of angels coming to speak to someone was not ridiculous. So the story was told from that perspective, that Dark Ages perspective, which and it was told by largely people who were very initially faithful, or they believed in her, and it got sort of encrusted with additional little embellishments or the embroidery of the truth. And one example that's a good one is her touching the infant, mm-hmm. who had been dead for 3 days, and it came back to life. Now, she was grilled about that in the trial, and she didn't deny that it was true, but she didn't actually confirm it either. And, you know, you have an event where you've got a small situation. There's a family with a dead child, and there's Joan of Arc, who is this completely mega famous person at this point, and they brought the baby to her, and supposedly she touched it, and it came alive for a little while, and then it died baptized, which was really the important thing, that mm-hmm. it didn't die unbaptized. Who can say what the truth is about a story like that? You know, that was one. It was not particularly well documented. It was perhaps a rumor. But there is a core of truth. And she means different things as time goes by. And so it's interesting to see how narrative is put together, especially because her life story aligns, or her messianic trajectory aligns so closely with that of Jesus's, that part of it has to do with how the story is told. You know, for example, her birthday, which is traditionally celebrated on the 6th of January, or Epiphany. Nobody took note of birthdays back then. She herself said in the trial, they said, how old are you? She said, 19, I think. Mm-hmm. And Epiphany is the day on which the Magi supposedly came to Jesus and honored him as the king, God. Somehow over the years, January 6th became Joan's birthday, because it's also sort of an annunciation and it's another validation of her connection to God. But that's made up.
Maybe it's a technicality. I mean, I'm sure she didn't consider it one, but she led people into battle, but she didn't actually take a life herself?
She carried her standard, which was a 12-foot banner with Jesus and the angels and the world at his feet. And she said that she carried the banner and not a sword, because she never intended to kill anyone. And, you know, you can say that there's something sort of that you can't really claim not to have shed any blood if you're in charge of hundreds of men and you're telling them to slaughter. Mm-hmm. And in fact, she aroused a kind of bloodlust in her soldiers that was hard to turn off. And, you know, I think that, well, first of all, she chased off all the camp followers, so there was no prostitution. She didn't let them gamble, which they really liked to do. There was no swearing, but they could keep killing, and they did sometimes. And she used, in her threats, her dictated threats, she used very violent language. You know, she promised a massacre, she would say, if they didn't submit to her army.
I didn't realize she wasn't canonized until the 20th century.
Yeah. This is largely because the trial documents were in some dusty basement of the National Library of France or something, but they were rediscovered around 1850 and immediately were an object of great interest. And, you know, canonization is really the church validating somebody who has a huge cult of personality around them, and the church can't control it. So they better make her into a saint if people are worshiping her already. And that's where they got to by 1920.
The new book by Catherine Harrison is called Joan of Arc, A Life Transfigured. Catherine is in town to appear tonight as part of the Highland Park United Methodist Church's Authors Live series. I'll be there with her this evening. Catherine, thank you so much for joining us.
No, thank you for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer, with help on the phones today from Christina Martinez. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.